Case number 14-5183, Jeffrey Cutler, Appellant v. United States Department of Health and Human Services et al. Mr. Muse for the Appellant, Ms. Allen for the Appellees.
May it please the Court, I'm Robert Muse from the American Freedom Law Center, and it's my honor and privilege to represent the plaintiff appellant in this case, Mr. Jeffrey Cutler, who was acting pro se below. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Now, the threshold issue presented today is whether Mr. Cutler has standing to advance this legal challenge to provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And under established law, the answer is clearly yes. The requirements for standing are well known. Plaintiff must allege a personal injury that's fairly traceable to the challenged conduct and likely to be redressed by the requested relief. Mr. Cutler satisfies all three of those requirements in this case.
Can you focus in addressing that on standing to raise the equal protection challenge as opposed to the required insurance challenge, the establishment clause challenge?
Well, the equal protection is it's related to that because it's the disparate enforcement of the Affordable Care Act, and it's essentially based on where somebody presently might reside.
What evidence do you have that it's disparate? I mean, the Arkansas policy looks exactly the same to me as the Pennsylvania policy.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The Arkansas policy and the Pennsylvania policy seem to me to be exactly the same. Neither one mandates that an insurance company continue policies. So how is it disparate?
Well, you certainly, and if you take a broader look at this, the transitional policy certainly permits applicable individuals who would otherwise have to have an Affordable Care Act compliant policy, and if they didn't have that, they'd be subject to penalties. Well, in the state of Pennsylvania, particularly for the case of Mr. Cutler wasn't able to keep the health care plan that he wanted, and as a result, it was canceled, and because it was canceled, he's now subject to penalties. There are other applicable individuals in the United States who are able to keep their plan, meaning they have a plan that is not compliant with the Affordable Care Act, but yet they are still being subject to penalties.
But isn't the reason they have a plan and Mr. Cutler doesn't because of the independent decision-making of the insurance company?
The fact is the requirement is a federal law requirement to have an Affordable Care Act compliant plan. The law makes it very clear that the secretary shall enforce that. So
I want to make sure we stay focused on an
yes.
equal protection challenge because I didn't see in your complaint a general challenge to the adoption of the transition policy at all. And so, in fact, we're even entertaining
right.
legal protection ones out there either, but for purposes, at least was raised below. So put aside any argument about whether there should or should not have been a transitional policy. That's not your case.
Right.
That's not this complaint. So what I really would like you to focus on is how is Mr. Cutler being treated differently for equal protection purposes from anyone else in the country in a way that is attributable to governmental action rather than independent choice of insurance companies?
Right, because the penalties that he is being assessed for not having an Affordable Care Act plan, one that is compliant with the plan, don't come from an insurance company, nor do they come from a state agency. They come from the federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly, in terms of redressability...
So you have to find someone else who's similarly situated who isn't being assessed a penalty. So somebody else who is in a state made it optional for insurance companies.
Right.
And the insurance company said, we're not doing it. And yet that person is not getting assessed a penalty. That's how I would understand an equal protection challenge in this context. Have you found somebody who has no insurance because their insurance company said, we're not going to do it, even though state X lets us, and isn't being assessed a penalty?
Yeah, but I don't think that's the correct analysis, Your Honor.
I think that's an equal protection challenge.
Well, the equal protection challenge is, right now, you look at it from this perspective. You have Mr. Cutler is an applicable individual who is required to have an ACA compliant plan And if he doesn't have that plan, he's subject to penalties under
federal
law.
He's required to have either an ACA-compliant plan or a non-ACA-compliant plan if his insurance company is willing to give it to him, which is an independent decision of the insurance company.
But if the penalties are accruing because he doesn't have an ACA-compliant plan. The law requires everyone to have an ACA-compliant plan, and that's why he's having penalties. When his insurance plan was canceled, he could not get a non-compliant ACA plan, and he's subject to penalties. He should not be, at a minimum, he should not be subject to those penalties, and that's the court can redress that injury, certainly. Now, certainly the Secretary of Department of Health and Human Services is established by federal law now, because now since the ACA was passed, the legal landscape has changed for insurance. Insurance has become nationalized, and the Secretary is one that shall enforce all the provisions of it. If Mr. Cutler was not able to have an ACA-compliant plan, whereas others who are able to keep non-ACA-compliant plans without having a penalty, he should not be subject to penalties as a result of his inability to get to keep the plan that he wanted based on what the president's promise, which is what was the basis for this transitional plan. There are individuals. Now you have a patchwork. Sorry, ma'am.
I just wanted to clarify one thing on the record, because as I understood at least the arguments below, and I know he was pro se, his argument there was it was an equal protection problem because Arkansas was requiring insurance companies to give non-compliant plans consistent with the transition policy, and Pennsylvania wasn't. I want to make sure. I think you agreed, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, that was his misunderstanding of Arkansas law, and in fact, no state in this country has mandated that insurance companies provide non-compliant plans. Is that your understanding of the law?
What was raised below was, and it was in a motion for summary judgment and then a response, and obviously the government has argued that it's been waived, and we certainly argue that he still has it available, is that the Affordable Care Act is being enforced in a disparate manger.
There weren't specifics below,
Your Honor. When we filed our opening brief, and I quite frankly, I read that Arkansas, when you look at what the Commissioner of Insurance of Pennsylvania said, essentially this transitional policy we think is unconstitutional, the government, federal government is the one who's responsible for enforcing this thing, we're just going to get out of the way. In Arkansas, and certainly I would need to do more development of this on the factual side, but again, we picked this case up pro se, but we certainly, and that's one of the things we've mentioned, is that we could perhaps remand this case so he can amend his complaint as necessary to flesh out this equal protection claim, but that's the argument he raised below in his summary judgment was that based on this transitional policy, he attached a copy of the March 11th description of that policy, that now the Affordable Care Act is being enforced in a disparate manner where some individuals have non-compliant plans and not subject.
I think you would agree, as a lawyer, which he was not, obviously, as a lawyer, he had to show that there was somebody who was similarly situated to him who was being treated differently to have an equal protection claim. Put aside the establishment.
And I would say a person who has a non-compliant plan, they should be subject to penalty. But they're not because of the transitional policy.
How is he injured by someone else not being subject to a penalty?
Well, that's that problem that we raised and we mentioned on the reply about the under-inclusive statute. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you can always make that sort of argument for an under-inclusive statute,
but
like the Orr versus Orr and the others that we cited.
But they're not similarly situated because that other person has insurance that's consistent with federal law.
It's a non-compliant plan.
It's only non-compliant if you're challenging the transitional policy, which you are not. And so we have to take as given. I understand you have other arguments. Maybe that's another case. But we have to take as given that it's ACA plus the transitional policy, none of which is challenged. That's governing federal law. And so if he has an insurance policy that complies with ACA and or transitional policy, that person is in compliance with federal law. And so that person is not similarly situated to your client.
Well, I would disagree in this respect, too, Your Honor, because I think the challenge to the transitional policy is essentially an as-applied challenge to how the individual mandate is being applied. He's not challenging the underlying authority, whether it violates separation of powers or, the underlying authority to issue the transitional policy, but the application of the transitional policy has a disparate impact on individuals.
Well, disparate impact is not an equal protection problem. Equal protection requires discriminatory intent and similarly situated individuals. So you don't,
right, and you have, you have, you have a law that's being enforced unequally. And it's largely dependent upon the state in which within a person resides. And we cited that other, you know, the Sons case, that the government can't you know, affirmatively permit a state or state government to violate equal protection. And so you have, you have this, again, you have this patchwork of enforcement of the Affordable Care Act based essentially upon where a person resides. And I do think in Arkansas, when you read what that press release was, there are individuals with non-compliant plans that are able to keep their plan in the state of Arkansas, whereas Mr. Cutler was not, and he's subject to penalty as a result.
Okay.
At a minimum, the penalties create an equal protection problem because there's a disparate enforcement, an unequal enforcement of the Affordable Care Act across the board.
I just want to make sure that maybe, so your equal protection argument is that the transitional policy violates equal protection clause, or that the Affordable Care Act violates the equal protection clause?
The enforcement of the individual mandate, where through the transitional policy, which allows it to be enforced unequally, it's not being enforced across the board to everyone, that creates an equal protection problem.
So if there were no transitional policy, in your view, the equal protection challenge would go away. You have other challenges, but the equal protection one is simply a product of the transitional policy. Am I understanding this right?
It's because it's an unequal enforcement of the law. Yes, I mean if the
yes,
Affordable Care Act,
because of the
transitional policy, how the law is being enforced, it creates an equal protection problem. And as a result, Mr. Cutler is subject to penalties. And that is an injury that's fairly traceable to that. And if you look at from an under-inclusive statute perspective, I think he meets that. I believe I'm already out of time. Any other questions?
We'll give you some time in reply. Ms. Allen?
Thank you, Judge Henderson, and may it please the Court. I would just like to clarify the equal protection challenge that's before the court and what the transitional policy does. Plaintiff has claimed that the transitional policy violates equal protection, and what the transitional policy does is HHS adopted a policy whereby health insurance issuers could continue coverage that they otherwise would have canceled because it would have been in violation of circuit market reforms under the Affordable Care Act. And HHS said that it would not enforce those market reforms against the health insurance issuers, and it encouraged states to adopt the same policy. Pennsylvania adopted that policy. So that meant that insurers in Pennsylvania that would have had to cancel their coverage could instead decide to continue that coverage. But plaintiff's health insurance issuer decided not to continue that coverage. So the injury that he's claiming, which is that he owes a tax penalty, is due to the health insurance issuer's decision not to allow him to continue that coverage. It's not attributable to the transitional policy which Pennsylvania adopted.
What about your argument on standing as to put aside the transitional policy, just the requirement to have insurance generally to have to comply with the individual insurance requirement?
Sure. Your Honor, are you referring to the establishment clause challenge?
Of course. Yes.
So, again, the injury the plaintiff claims is that he has to pay the tax penalty.
Doesn't that satisfy Article 3?
Sorry?
That satisfies Article 3. I have to pay it. Religious folks don't. Why doesn't that satisfy standing? No merits, just standing right now.
Well, so the injury he claims is having to pay the tax penalty. And that injury is not redressable by the relief he seeks, which is declaring the religious conscience exemption invalid. He asserted in district court that if the religious conscience exemption were invalid, then the individual coverage provision as well as the entire Affordable Care Act.
That's when he got his point about the under-inclusive statutes, right? Then you're going to be in a position, either a severability analysis or congressional action, to decide, do we want the statute with or without the religious exemption, or do we need to make it a broader conscientious objector exemption would be an option. We don't know what the remedial response would be, but he's got, for Article 3 standing purposes, he said, I'm injured, I'm having to pay something, and person X over there is not, and we're engaged in the exact same behavior of not having insurance. Why isn't that standing?
Well, I have two responses to that. First is that in contrast to the state cases that are referenced in plaintiff's reply brief, In this case, we think it's very clear that as a matter of federal law, the remedy for invalidating the religious conscience exemption would not be to also invalidate the individual coverage provision. Congress specifically said that the individual coverage provision is essential to the reforms of the Affordable Care Act, and the Supreme Court recognized in NFIB that the purpose of the Affordable Care Act was to increase the number of Americans covered by health insurance and decrease the cost.
Sounds like a severability argument, but not an injury argument.
Well, we think because of the clear nature of this, the fact that the religious conscience exemption would be severable, that that makes clear that the injury, the particular injury he's claiming here, is not redressable. The other response I would have, Your Honor, is just that to emphasize how different this case is from the other cases in which courts have considered the Social Security tax exemption that was incorporated in the religious conscience exemption. In those cases, the plaintiff was a member of a religious group or a person who had a conscientious objection to the tax, and so was essentially arguing that the exemption was too limited and should be extended to include their group. But here, that's not the situation that we have, because the plaintiff has no religious objection to insurance. Indeed, he used to have health insurance, and he does not even have a conscientious, non-religious objection to health insurance for the same reason. And so we think this case is quite different than the other cases in which courts have reached the merits of this sort of exemption. If the court has no further questions, then we submit the district court's decision should be affirmed for the reasons stated in our brief.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have one question.
Oh. Yes.
If we reach the merits, in Larson, in that footnote that you reference, the court is discussing why the statute is facially unconstitutional. But in describing the statute in this footnote, I just want to know what to do with the footnote, because it says the distinction between different religious organizations, well-established churches, and churches which are new. What do we do with the 1950 cutoff date?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, the 1950 cutoff date that's in Section 1402G of the Social Security tax that's incorporated by reference, that's really not an issue here, because plaintiff is not someone who is a member of a religion that was established in 1951 and that's claiming that that particular restriction...
He doesn't have to be in order for his establishment clause claim, does he?
I think he does, Your Honor, because if any of the other restrictions, even just the fact that he must be a member of a religious group that has a conscientious objection, if that were valid, he still could not claim the religious conscience exemption. And so he really has...
I'm not following that.
Sorry. So he
does
not...
In other words, what I am understanding his challenge to be is the statute on its face, by incorporating the provision of the Social Security Act, which has a cutoff date, is, he doesn't say it this way, but I'm just looking at the way the circuits and your brief are reading Larson, and I just want to understand whether your position, well, your position is that the statute is not facially unconstitutional.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in Larson stated that the statute made explicit and deliberate distinctions based on religious denomination. In particular...
No, no. See, that's what I want you to focus on. You don't have the footnote in front of you, do you?
I can get it.
All right. This is Larson. All right. It's footnote number 23, page 246.
Yes.
See where the court is describing the statute?
Yes.
It's not talking about denominations as such. It's just talking about well-established versus new.
That's correct. And the legislative history in Larson, showed that the state legislature had passed the 51% requirement in order to
I understand that. But what I'm trying to understand is in Larson, is the court saying we conclude the statute is facially unconstitutional because of the legislative history or because the statute is facially a violation?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court reads the statute in light of the legislative history, which it says makes clear that the legislature implemented the 51%.
So even if the statute has the effect of distinguishing between established and new, there would not be an Establishment Clause violation?
Well, Your Honor, all the courts of appeals to consider Section 4.
I know, and they've just parroted the language without much consideration of this description that the Supreme Court has given of what was the problem.
Well, I think, Your Honor, later in the Larson opinion, the Supreme Court makes clear that the reason,
So we really ought not to worry too much about this footnote since the rest of the opinion is clearly talking about denominational distinctions.
Well, I don't think it's just about denominations, but the point was that they, as on page 254 of the opinion, where the court is talking about the fact that the legislature adopted the 51% rule in order to have certain religions be tax exempt and not have to follow these reporting requirements, but to have newly established churches that solicited donations from non-members to not allow them to take advantage of the same exemption from the reporting requirements. And so that deliberate, it was on purpose to allow the Catholic Church to be included, but to not allow other more, churches that solicited from non-members to be included. And so the Supreme Court, looking at that legislative history, determined that the statute was drafted with the, quote, explicit intention of including particular religious denominations and excluding others. And
so it was facially invalid. I just need to be clear how you're reading Larson.
You mean facially invalid as opposed to as applied?
Well,
I just don't quite understand. I don't think I'm following the question.
Well, do you see what I'm concerned about in the footnote?
So
where the Supreme Court draws the distinction not between the Catholic Church and others, but just between old and new.
Well, I think the legislative history maps right onto that distinction because what...
In the Larson case, I
yes.
agree. All right. But just in my hypothetical, ignore the legislative history for a moment. If all you have is what the court thought the problem was, as it described in this footnote, would we have a problem?
I don't think we have a problem here because as the courts of appeals... have explained, the reason for the specific requirements in Section 1402G are to ensure that people who claim the exemption from Social Security and Medicare, that those people are members of groups, of religious organizations that will care for their members when they become dependent.
So it doesn't cause any change in what standard the court applies, whether it's strict scrutiny as opposed to the Lemon test.
We do not believe so, Your Honor. As the other courts of appeals have held, the statute serves a secular purpose of, ensuring that the people who claim the exemption are cared for, and we think that's just as true here as the Fourth Circuit held.
The problem is that there's a separate part of the statute, apart from the 1950 line, that addresses that concern about a history of supporting. G1D specifically says somebody has defined it's a practice and has been for a period of time which he deems to be substantial.
Right.
For members of such sector division to make provision for their dependent members. So you have a separate provision of the statute that addresses the evidence that they'll take care of members of the faith so that the Social Security, they don't become public wards and the Social Security system doesn't work the way it's supposed to. So I don't see what the 1950 or the cutoff year for ACCA or for Social Security Act is doing, what work it's doing, other than distinguishing between old and new?
Well, again, we think that that those two provisions, go hand in hand and serve the same purpose.
No, because B lets the secretary decide a period of time which he or she deems to be substantial, which would be very different than 1950.
Congress could have been setting a floor. This was passed in 1965, and so Congress could have been setting a floor that a religious group needed to have been around and doing that for at least 15 years. But again, just to get back to this case, the plaintiff does not have a religious objection to health insurance. He is not someone who would have standing to challenge this particular requirement, because if any of the requirements are valid, he still cannot claim the religious conscience exemption, because he doesn't meet the fundamental requirement of having a religious objection to insurance.
Because I thought his argument was different, and that was you can't have a statute that says I get penalized, and that person doesn't for religious reasons. Put aside the contours of the religious exemption, you just can't have a statute that makes this differentiation where the penalty, I guess they'll tell me if I'm wrong, where the penalty turns on whether you're religious or not.
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has long recognized that Congress can accommodate religions without violating the Establishment Clause. And even the plaintiff at page 25 of his brief recognizes that religious accommodations are permissible. He then goes on to say that this one is not permissible because he claims that it plainly rewards certain religious beliefs and thus sects over others. But he is not a member of a group with another religious belief or of a sect that's excluded.
He's a person who's getting treated differently because he's not religious. Whatever the sect or whatever, I'm getting treated differently because I'm not religious. Is that an Establishment Clause problem?
Well,
I think that's what you need to address.
I think that there's a mismatch between the sort of broader argument he seems to be claiming and the legal argument he makes, which is that the exemption distinguishes between religious denominations where he's not a member of one that's excluded, in contrast to the other cases addressing 1402G, where the person was a member of a group that they were claiming was excluded.
I understood his argument to be that this is discrimination between religion and irreligion, non-religion.
And
what would the answer be then?
It's the same answer, Your Honor. All of the courts of appeals to consider this exception, and the Supreme Court has also considered the exception in the context of a free exercise challenge. They've all recognized that Section 1402G and the Fourth Circuit recognized that the religious conscience exemption in the Affordable Care Act, that it was enacted to narrowly accommodate religious practices while at the same time ensuring that the people who claim the exemption are cared for. And the exemption in the Affordable Care Act serves the same purpose that Section 1402G has served since 1965 when it was enacted as part of the Social Security Act.
And is it your position that the Social Security exemption sort of would function in the same way, in that it would, if you didn't, I guess, have your taxes withheld for Social Security, a penalty, although it might be on your employer rather than you, but if you're self-employed, you'd have to pay a penalty. You either have to pay the tax, make the payment that the law requires, or pay a penalty, or establish that you fall within this religious exemption.
Your Honor, I'm not sure about the specifics of whether there's a penalty for failing to pay Social Security tax, but it is an exemption from paying Social Security taxes. Thank you.
Thank you. Does Mr. Muse have any time? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Millett, you're right. His distinction that he's making for the Established Clause standing is religion versus non-religion.
So if
Everson made that point. But we've also alleged that he conscientiously objects to having to buy insurance pursuant to the Affordable Care Act, subject to penalty, but not based on religious grounds. And so it's religion versus religion.
Can I ask you just a quick question? If you were right on the Establishment Clause, would that necessarily invalidate the Social Security exemption, or how would you distinguish? Do they rise or fall together? Because Supreme Court has told us the Social Security one meets constitutional standards, and the Affordable Care Act just piggybacks right on it.
Right, and I think there's a distinction between the Social Security Act and the Affordable Care Act and how they operate. And the case where the Supreme Court addressed 1402G was in the context of a free exercise clause. And I want to get to Judge Rogers.
But I just want to make sure I have an answer from you.
I don't think necessarily.
Social Security, okay, and how would you legally how would you legally distinguish for Establishment Clause purposes, given what the Supreme Court said in United States versus Lee, the Social Security from ECA?
Right, and remember in United States versus Lee, it essentially the court concluded that there was a compelling interest, even though they found that there was a burden on the free exercise, that there was a compelling interest because of the nature of the Social Security system and how
know,
it's very.
We all know now that that's not how. That after the Oregon case, that's not how free exercise claims are analyzed. But, you know,
right.
They've cited to Lee since then. They think it's constitutional.
But I think that the two types of systems are themselves different. And you made the point about the penalty. I mean, he's going to have a penalty for not having an Affordable Care Act compliant plan, whereas people with religious beliefs can be exempt from that. One of the main things in these cases for the upholding the 1402G under the Establishment Clause is the claim that the person who, if you're going to grant that exemption, you have to waive all benefits to Social Security. And so the court has said that shows that it doesn't have the primary effect of advancing or inhibiting religion. You don't have anything near that
to a waiver of all
benefits.
The Affordable Care Act incorporates that provision, as I understand it, of the Social Security Act that would require your client to have an opposition to all forms of insurance, whether health or
somebody's injured, they take to the hospital. The hospital's going to treat them in the hospital. They're going to have medical care under federal law,
medical
no matter what.
Medical care and insurance are not the same thing.
But what's the benefits that year? It's the federal benefits. I do think the two systems are different, and I do want to get to Judge Rogers' point because I think it's very important. The only case that I recall that addressed the 1400G issue after Larson was the Droz case, and they gave short shrift. Just the footnote that you pointed out is exactly right. The court said this isn't simply a facially neutral statute. It makes explicit and deliberate distinctions between different religious organizations. And how did it do that? Based on how they do their charitable donations. If 50% come from members and affiliated organizations, then they have an exemption. They didn't. This provision makes explicit and deliberate distinctions based on religious beliefs and religious tenets. It is far more. It's far less facially neutral than the statute at issue in Larson versus Valenti. It is incomprehensible that these two that they comply. If you Droz just gave it short shrift, Liberty University then just relied on Droz and gave it short shrift. If you read the Larson versus Valenti, it's incomprehensible to conclude that this exemption doesn't make deliberate and express distinctions based on religious beliefs and religious tenets, and that's impermissible. Even this court's decision in the Priest for Life case, with the religious exemption that was involved in the HHS mandate, the court said made distinctions based on organizational form and purpose, not religious beliefs or denominations.
I was going to draw your attention to that, but we held in that case as to the regulations that it drew the distinction based on organizational form and purpose,
right,
and not religious belief or denomination.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So that cuts against your argument.
No, Your Honor. What that shows is that it wasn't based specific. The court said it wasn't based on religious beliefs or denominations, assuming that if it had, it would violate the Establishment Clause. This exemption expressly states it's based on religious beliefs and religious teachings. Specific tenets of religious beliefs.
Where does it say that?
The religious exemption? It applies to a member of a recognized religious sect or division who is an adherent of established tenets or teachings of such sect or division.
Right.
I mean, it's referring specifically to the teachings, the religious teachings, not even to the organization.
The conscientious objector case.
Right.
You know, in the sense that if you have any religion or anything, and so your point is that it is an Establishment Clause violation to base a distinction on religion versus non-religion. Well, that's your bottom line.
That's what the Supreme Court has said in Larson versus, again, I don't see how this can stand in light of Larson versus Valenti.
Cutter versus Wilkinson, which held
yes.
Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, which precisely differentiation based on religion.
No, I think there's a difference between a general religious accommodation, because they apply, you have a penalty or you have some provision that will apply across the board, and then somebody can come forward, and not based on any specific religious sect or division. For example, whether you're Catholic, whether you're Amish, whether you're Jewish, you could say there's a specific provision that I believe substantially burdens my religious beliefs, and then there's an analysis that the court applies.
Okay, but your argument now takes down the Social Security exemption, too.
Right. I don't think it necessarily does, but I think there's a big problem with Larson. I think 1402OG has a big problem with Larson versus Lincoln.
I just want to make sure we understand what the scope of your argument is.
Right, but I'm not here to argue, for or against 1402G, but I think Larson versus Valenti makes it very difficult to uphold the Affordable Care Act, how it's drafted. Even though it relies on 1402G, I think how it's drafted and in the context of health care, I don't see how it stands in light of Larson versus Valenti.
All right, thank you.